from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We are a very distinct sort of people. We're self-selected risk takers, and safetyism is not something that we usually subscribe to, but I have to say, after this COVID thing, I'm a little bit more worried as I was writing this book about where we're headed.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's David Harsanyi, author of the new book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. We'll talk at length with David in just a bit about his new book. But first, we're joined by Dr. Paul Marino, William and Bertie Screwcock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences, and for our purposes today, big baseball fan and historian. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
My son and I, he's eight, and we just finished up a book on Jackie Robinson. We read it together, and I thought that would be, we're in the midst of baseball season now. Let's talk a bit about Jackie Robinson, his life, his career, breaking the color barrier. Let's talk about that dynamic of it. Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, he's the one who decides that the Dodgers are going to integrate. The Dodgers are going to have a black baseball player. What was his reason? Why did he want to do that?
Yeah, that's one of the great sort of disputed questions among historians of the subject. Rickey was such a complicated character. He was a very devout Methodist. He had a sense of Christian brotherhood, which is probably very genuine. He probably saw this as, segregation was a stain on the American escutcheon he wanted to do something about. He was also a really shrewd and sharp businessman. Who really was a transformative figure in sort of modern Major League Baseball, that basically invented the farm system that turned a small market team like the Cardinals into a powerhouse. But he recognized that blacks were, both the potential to get black players to make your team better so people will come out and see the games, and also to tap into the black audience, that he saw sort of the Negro leagues and the separate sort of captive market which existed in every, segregated market in America as something that he could profit by. And when baseball was interesting, because in 1947, when it integrated, it was really one of the first major American institutions to do so. And baseball at the time, dominated American sports in a way, nothing like it is today, where it really had no competition from professional sports of any other kind. It really was the American pastime. And so integrating that institution probably was more important than a lot of the civil rights legislation that was coming along at the same time. And, baseball had actually been integrated in the 19th century. Technically speaking, there were a couple of brothers, Weldy and Fleetwood Walker in the 19th century, who played for a Toledo team, which was at the time a major league team. Toledo's always been kind of a major league AAA team. And at the behest of the white players, principally, they were driven out of the major leagues. The players forced the owners to first adopt a cap as, one or five black players per team and then exclude them entirely, because the white players wanted to monopolize the jobs in baseball. And since baseball is a monopoly or a cartel, and the only legally, protected one in the United States, they were able to do that.
Jack Robinson, after his military service, plays for the Negro Leagues, Kansas City Monarchs. And he was a very good player, not the best player. Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, you had other players who might have been more talented. So why did Branch Rickey target Jackie Robinson to be this player?
Also, to do this in Brooklyn at the time, to bring him up through the Dodgers farm system, because New York had a large black population. Again, the integration of the major leagues. Almost immediately after the Dodgers integrated, the Cleveland Indians were the first American League team to integrate. And, the American demographic was changing. This is the Great Migration of the two world wars. Blacks have been moving into American cities in large numbers. And so, it's probably an indication that Rickey was aware of both the talent of black players like Robinson. Again, you had to get, the right ones. He had to, believe it or not, he had to get over the sense that a lot of people had that blacks couldn't play the game as well as whites. People still believe this, even though very quickly, as soon as Major League Baseball integrated, blacks being about 12% of the population reached, more than that proportion of Major League talent. So you know, just the Robinson had to prove, just had to show it on the field that blacks were able to play the game as well as whites, when statistically speaking, they were able to play the game better than whites. But that was the popular prejudice that he had to overcome.
Talking with Dr. Paul Marino about Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball. April 15th, 1947, Robinson's first game with the Dodgers as a 28-year-old. He'd win Rookie of the Year. It is first year, I think the very first year of the Rookie of the Year award in Major League Baseball. Tell us a little bit, what kind of a player was Jackie Robinson?
He was a five-tool player, as I say today. I mean, he could do everything. He was an exciting player, too. I mean, the speed on the base paths, especially, you know, the number of times that he stole home. He did take the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, almost overnight from, you know, a decent team to a, you know, really predominant team, a team that could challenge the Yankees regularly in the postseason. So he did. This is a part of what Branch Rickey had in mind, that he would improve the quality of the team. It would make the Dodgers contenders and would increase attendance and then, you know, and other elements that flow from that. So he did exactly what economists say that players should do. He, you know, added marginal value to the Dodgers, much more than what he was being paid by Branch Rickey, or that he would have been paid by anybody else as well. Because this is the period where you still had the reserve clause, which later black players like Curt Flood likened to slavery, in which the best players especially were underpaid relative to what they contributed to the team. And Rickey was a great defender of the reserve clause and was well aware that he was getting more than his money's worth when he signed Jackie Robinson.
Now, just getting to play with the Dodgers and proving himself against other players was not it, because there were other hurdles, right, in terms of travel, in terms of accommodations. Jackie Robinson couldn't stay in the same hotels with the rest of his players, with the rest of his teammates.
Yeah, and although this is sort of Washington and St. Louis would be the only cities that were still in segregated states. Ironically enough, at the time, baseball was almost, you know, still entirely upper, you know, Midwestern and Northeastern. That would have been a bigger problem later on. It would have been a bigger problem in the minor leagues, especially where you had Southern teams. But yes, that was a problem for, of course, you know, diplomats from, you know, other countries staying in Washington, D.C. And one of the things that in the 1960s drove the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But baseball was able to do this, where they were able to say to, you know, we're not going to play, we're not going to participate in cities that don't respect our players. They had the power to do that.
Robinson, of course, proves to be the right choice. Multiple All-Star, MVP of the league in 1949, ended up winning a World Series in 1956, and I believe his final year in baseball. The Yankees kept getting in their way, the Dodgers' way.
55, the Dodgers finally won, yes. Yeah. And 56, the Yankees took it back.
I was going to ask about his legacy. I think that's relatively clear.
Number 42 has now been retired from every team.
That's right.
There's Jackie Robinson Day, and yeah, he's in many ways, because, you know, sort of dealing with the race problem, which has been the central problem in all of American history, in the thing that, as I said, was the national pastime, the integration of baseball in 1947 really was a milestone in American history.
In post-baseball career for Jackie Robinson, he was very interesting. You know, he became a VP for Chocolate Dunn's Coffee. He became, I believe, the first black national broadcaster for sports, for baseball games, and then died young, I believe the age of 54.
He did die young, and he was also a Republican. He supported the Republican Party, you know, in sort of the Eisenhower years. And that's another good indication of the way in which sort of race relations were in flux in this period, because the Republican Party had been traditionally, you know, the party of Lincoln, and blacks were, you know, voted at pretty much 100% Republican where they could vote up until the New Deal. And then the black vote was in play. Part of what you see going on in baseball, where you had sort of competition for black consumers and for black players, was also taking place in politics in America, where both parties were appealing for the black vote. And that didn't really shake out the way that we know it today until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Robinson did sort of repudiate the Republican Party late in his life.
Dr. Paul Marino, William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences, big baseball fan, Yankees fan. Won't hold that against him. Dr. Marino, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free.
Thanks very much, Hillsdale. For having me.
Up next, we talk with David Harsanyi. His brand new book is called Eurotrash: Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. You can also find older episodes of the program there, too. We're joined now by David Harsanyi. He is a senior writer at National Review and also the author of the new book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. David, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Reading through the book, one will see the word Europhiles sprinkled liberally. Let's begin by getting your definition. When you refer to a Europhile, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about an American, typically an elite in academia or a pundit or perhaps a politician, actually quite often politicians these days, who glorify and overrate European life, who believe Europe is Europeans are more sophisticated, have better ideas about how to run the world. Typically, these are technocrats and, in my view, quite often authoritarian in their political views. And they want to either compel us or convince us that we should be more like Europe. And so that I had to come up with a sort of a tag rather than having to explain that each time.
Why generally do you think that those elites, the Europhiles, are overestimating, overstating the success or the superiority, if you want to say, of these Western European countries?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there are a number of reasons why. I think simply because of how government is run there, you know, we'll call it socialistic, but it's more sort of statist. I mean, usually you have capitalism propping up giant welfare states. And I think this is the ideal for many people on the left here. They're not going to get, the government's not going to have the means of production here. So the next best thing is this kind of system. So I think that they like that system. The Paul Krugman of the world like that kind of technocratic world where, you know, pliant population listens to its government, where it's extremely centralized, where the powerful, you know, not only do what's best for the people, but what's best for the world, let's say, or how they see it. But, you know, there's another part of it where I think there are folks who go to Europe and they hang out at these touristy areas, and it's beautiful and wonderful, and the history is incredible, and they think that's what Europe is about. They don't see, you know, they don't go out into the suburbs where immigrants are, a dense suburb where immigrants aren't working and there are all these problems. So I think that those are two of the reasons. And, you know, I guess the third is that these days and more increasingly people just think America is a terrible place. They think we're a racist country. They think that we were born in sin and that we need to change and to be more like a place that has gone through two world wars in the last 100 years.
You make a point very early on in the book, David, that most good ideas travel west to east, not the other way around, not the way that many Europhiles would say we have to adopt these European ways. What are some of those good ideas we've seen go the other direction from the United States to Western Europe?
Well, after World War II, a good idea was not to, you know, massacre each other, and I think the United States has kept the peace in many ways in Europe for a long time, merely by its presence there in some sense. But more than that, I mean, after World War II, the Europeans took on many capitalistic ideas. There were huge economic booms in places like Germany and elsewhere, in Italy for a while, in France, that were predicated on ideas that Americans embraced, you know, open free markets. I mean, initially those ideas came from Europe to the United States, but they manifested here in ways that they didn't there. Even the European Union itself, the early founders or thinkers or people who wanted to create it based the idea on the United States. They thought about, they talked about federalism. They talked about the, you know, loose control of an economic, you know, they wanted, you know, the European Union was formed to keep the peace, but it was also formed to compete with the United States. It hadn't turned out that way because in the end, the European Union has far more centralized control over how things work in its countries than was originally intended, I think. But I guess those are some of the ideas.
David Harsanyi is with us. Eurotrash is his new book, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. If we've heard certain countries cited more recently than others, we're talking about the Nordic countries, perhaps. We know Bernie Sanders is a big fan of those Nordic countries in Western Europe. Why would the Nordic model not work here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the first reason it wouldn't work is because of scale. You're talking about pretty small countries, very small countries. You're talking about Norway or Denmark, which is Bernie's favorite country, or even Sweden, which I think is the largest. One of them is 9 million people. So to have that kind of tax rates and taxation and government here would just create the biggest bureaucracy that ever existed on Earth, and it would be... It simply wouldn't work. But the question I think should be this: why would we want it at all? It is not, they don't do anything better than we do here. We are far better at entrepreneurship. And don't get me wrong, Scandinavian, Nordic countries are very successful. They're not successful because of the huge welfare state. They've been, since the mid-90s, trying to deregulate some of that. Many of their institutions are, in fact, quite capitalistic, or even less, you know, with less regulatory burden than we have. Basically, when people talk about those states, they're talking about socialized medicine, and they're talking about, you know, a giant welfare state. But it simply wouldn't work here because of scale. That's the first thing. And secondly, because it's not in the DNA of an American typically to pay, say, 65% of their wages and taxation to create this state. I mean, you can't even raise taxes on the middle class now. Not even Democrats try to do that, and the rich people can't pay for that kind of system on their own.
David, there's a section on health care, and we do hear a lot about socialized medicine and universal health care, like those Western European countries feature. Is there enough data to say, though, that in essence Americans get what we pay for, meaning it may cost a bit more, it's structured differently, but the outcomes are better here in the U.S.?
I would say the outcomes are better in the U.S. in many ways. Now, I must concede ahead of this when we talk about health care that it's not as if Europe has bad health care. You know, these are pretty good health care systems, some better than others. Like England, for instance, struggles in many ways, but I mean Britain. But we do pay more and we get more. We have, I mean, all leading technology here, the things that we do, the life that we lead are better because of the technology we have, and we have to pay for that. There's no doubt about that. But a lot of the things that sort of fans of socialized medicine bring up are simply untrue. For instance, longevity. We don't live as long as, you know, the average American does not live as long as someone in Belgium, let's say, but it's not because of the system, medical system. It's because we live different kinds of lives. We drive more. We have more vehicular deaths, for instance. Unfortunately, one of the things we don't do better is crime, as far as violent crime and homicides and things like that. It has nothing to do with the medical system. So, you know, in the book, you know, I dive down into the specifics of why a lot of these statistics that are thrown around by Europhiles here are misleading.
We'll pause right there with David Harsanyi, the author of the new book, Eurotrash. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Greetings to my fellow veterans. This is Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of Veterans Affairs for the state of California. I'm a Korean vet, and it was my honor to serve in the U.S. Army as a new immigrant to this great country. Thank you for your service. It will not be forgotten. It should be remembered that freedom is not free. It has been secured by brave sacrifice that all members of our military and their families have given since the beginning of a great, wonderful nation. Thank you for your service.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Since 1890, Stifel has established itself as one of the nation's leading wealth management and investment banking firms by understanding clients' hopes and dreams, focusing on building and preserving wealth. Simply put, when you achieve your goals, we achieve ours. I'm proud to be a part of Stifel as a financial advisor. This is Susan Eastman, First Vice President Investments. Call today for quality time well spent. 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
One 100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Building on our foundational promise to educate ministers and missionaries, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with David Harsanyi, senior writer at National Review and author of the new book, Eurotrash, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. David, in Eurotrash, there's an entire chapter in which you look at the data and tell us that America is a far more tolerant country than Western Europe, and the lack of integration in Europe leads to radicalism. Why is it that Europe has struggled to see the sort of integration that we, again, generally see here in the U.S.?
Well, so let's divide those topics. I think when you talk about tolerance here in the United States, higher than it's ever been in anywhere in human history. There's no place in the world where we live together as peacefully as we do here, despite what we're told constantly. I live in Maryland, outside of D.C., and I have neighbors from all over the world who would be killing each other in other instances, living together completely peacefully, living very similar lives, sometimes friends. So this has never happened in this way, to this scale, ever in human history, and it's always worth remembering that. I think people forget that because when you're in it, you might not understand the context of this, and certainly in Europe you don't have this. You've never had this. Even today, integrating one minority is difficult and almost impossible in Europe. That has a lot to do with immigration, the system and the structure of immigration that's gone on for a long time. In some countries, and more recently in Germany, Sweden, elsewhere, it's a new problem, really. So why do we assimilate people better? It's because we are a nation basically built to assimilate people. We have everyone's an immigrant here at one point in the near past. So we have ideals that everyone who comes here has to live by. So though they hold on to their culture and aspects of it. They have to give up things as well. We live, you know, we all come to an agreement that we are free to pursue the things we want to pursue, and that we don't, you know, that we allow people to practice their religions freely, that, the ideals of the Constitution and classical liberalism, basically. In Europe, those ideals are not, that expectation that people embrace those ideals doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because of compartmentalized places where immigrants live, in France, for instance, for decades, and in Germany for generationally. You have, for instance, Turkish immigrants who live in places when they still have sky-high unemployment. They're just not integrated into society. We do the opposite, and we do it also because we let people from all over the world come in. We don't have them coming from one place with one, you know, with all the baggage that comes along with that. So I think those are two of the reasons.
David Harsanyi is with us. Eurotrash is his new book, Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. The Thought Police chapter references, of course, our First Amendment, which is a pretty darn big difference between the United States and Western Europe. Do Americans appreciate the differences in the way that speech largely is treated in Western European countries?
I don't think so. I mean, I point out that now there are many writers and thinkers on the left and some on the right, frankly, who now, I don't think, you know, want us to be more like Western Europe in how we control speech. Now, obviously, it's a complicated question when you have big tech companies controlling speech, et cetera, but still. We have a First Amendment, and frankly, every country has a First Amendment. But the difference is that we've always treated the Constitution seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And Western Europe does not. Their Constitution is huge, and rights keep piling up, and sometimes they conflict with each other, and they don't take it seriously, and we do. And, you know, Europhiles in this country and progressives in this country don't want us to take it seriously. And that's why they're delegitimizing the Supreme Court constantly, and they hate originalism. But that's the difference. You know, I think Scalia had said it a few times. Everyone has a constitution, but the constitution doesn't matter. The people behind it and the system behind it do. So Europe does not care. I go through many, many instances of assaults on free speech. But I think the most important thing that I write about in Europe and that's different here is our self-censorship. You know, the way that Orwell talked about it, not in the Orwellian 1984 way, but rather in a society that is too scared to speak for the truth for mm-hmm. itself. Not that the state stops it, but they simply won't do it.
While we're on the subject of government and constitutions, I want to ask about the EU, the European Union. Is that organization, is that largely a drag on Western Europe? Is it limiting freedom and liberty for people in those countries?
Well, it does both. I mean, I think that, you know, there, as far as the trade agreements and allowing those countries to freely trade with each other, I think it's a good thing. But what happens is mission creep, and government always grows and bureaucracies always grow. And the European Union now tries to control the way that nations act, tries to undermine their culture in many ways, and creates a blob that is just an economic entity, meaning no one in the world, I don't think there's anyone in Europe who's going to pick up a musket and fight for the European Union, to defend the European Union. There's no idealism, right? There's no, so people crave some kind of purpose and meaning in their lives, and it won't be found in the European Union. It might be found in being Hungarian or being French, might be found in your faith, which is dying in Europe, but it won't be found in some economic, you know, corporatist bureaucracy, right? So I think that that's the problem. And but the European Union continues to tell people how to act in countries through tens of thousands of, you know, regulations over every and everything you can imagine. That's one of the reasons Brexit happened. The problem is many of the, you know, the stronger countries like Germany like it because they get to boss everyone around, and many of the smaller countries need it because that's how they, you know, they need the money, their net benefit as far as it goes with taxation. So it's complicated. I don't think the European Union as a trade agreement is a terrible idea, but I think as a entity of centralized government, it does drag the entrepreneur, you know, it undermines entrepreneurship and creativity and independence.
You have a small section on affordable energy in the Richer Than You chapter. Again, I don't know if Americans appreciate the costs of energy in Western Europe, many places, what, at least double where it is here in the U.S. Why is energy so expensive in those countries, and will it be getting more expensive here in the near future?
Well, it's more expensive in many places because of high taxation on energy, and also because of green policy is where, you know, European nations are trying they artificially make energy more fossil fuel, reliable energy more expensive in the same way that the Green New Deal and Democrats want to do here, frankly. I mean, it's to, you know, to depress use and to make people compel them to use different sorts of energy sources. But, you know, you had a country like Germany who had a very vibrant nuclear program that is the, you know, it's the best way to move forward probably if you're trying to, you know, deal with carbon emissions, and they got rid of it, and now they're going to get gas from Russia. So there are real, you know, real life sometimes smashes against your utopianism, and you are forced to deal with it. So it will be more expensive, but they will need it because green energy just isn't doing the job.
Final question here for David Harsanyi on Eurotrash. Are these efforts will they fall on deaf ears no matter what, because we Americans like to be different anyway? Is it sort of a lost cause to begin with?
God, I hope so. I mean, I think that Americans are, and, you know, listen, I romanticize us a little bit. I never believe that we're a utopia. We have tons of problems, but we are a very distinct sort of people. We're self-selected risk takers, and with that kind of risk, safetyism is not something that we usually subscribe to. But I have to say, after this COVID thing, I'm a little bit more, you know, worried as I was writing this book about where we're headed. And that has something to do with it as well. But I would say that there are large parts of this country that do not think that way. So even if you have the urban areas, you know, a lot of urbanites and progressives, which is, you know, a growing faction of our political ecosystem. So I think more people will think like Europe, but I don't think there are enough to change the country. And I think a lot of our problems, not problems, but a lot of our disagreements in politics are predicated on the fight between old America, you know, the old American and the European style government.
David Harsanyi, senior writer at National Review and author of the new book Eurotrash: Why America Must Reject the Failed Ideas of a Dying Continent. David, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we talk with Hillsdale history professor Corey Moss about the Renaissance philosopher Erasmus. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, KCNR1460.com, and AM 1460 has teamed up with Golden Valley Bank for Operation Holiday Salute to thank our veterans for their service, and a portion of the proceeds goes to help out local homeless veterans. Golden Valley Bank at 250 Hempstead Drive, Suite 100, creates a truly unique local banking experience. Talk to our relationship banker today at 222-4000. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Take a stroll down Memory Lane at Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage. Whether you're looking for tools from the past, vintage clothing, collectibles, jewelry, or something that just reminds you of the good old days, you can find it at Memory Lane. Those special shabby chic and vintage style items are seen in every nook and cranny. So what are you waiting for? Sure, you can check out their Facebook page, but it's a lot more fun to explore the past and find your treasure. 1665 Pine Street in Reading. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage.
Hi, this is Dan Beans, director of Reading Electric Utility. Now is a great time to prepare for this year's upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our facilities and to the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutters, and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming in proximity of power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR1460.com.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed, a new show on Sundays, 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
Back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello to our listeners in Anderson, South Carolina on WAIM Radio, 1230 AM. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Moss, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, in fact, marks the 555th anniversary of the birth of Erasmus. Who is Erasmus? What should we know about him, and why should we care?
Why should people know about Erasmus? Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, in his day, he was a kind of world-bestriding, or at least Europe-bestriding, public figure. His correspondence with everyone from kings, emperor, popes, to theologians, crisscrossed Europe. And he was in some ways the example par excellence of what we think of as the Renaissance man. Mm. I mean, it probably goes too far to hold him up as, you know, the Renaissance man. He doesn't represent all facets of the Renaissance, but he is a prime example of what that movement was about and the influence that it had.
How would you describe him as, why is he an important figure?
He's an important figure for a number of reasons. Perhaps the one that affects very, very, very many Americans, even if they don't know it, has to do with things like his textual criticism of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're reading the old King James Version or some modern edition of the Bible, in many ways the text underlying that goes back to Erasmus, you know, close examination of the existing Greek texts.
In terms of time period for Erasmus, we're talking about this era right around the Reformation.
Yeah, that's right. He's born in the 1460s. There's some debate about when exactly he was born, 1466, 1469. And then he lives into 1536. So he's there at the dawn of the Reformation. And very much involved, sometimes willingly, sometimes unwillingly, with the events that unfold there.
I think it was you who I heard describe Erasmus as, and if not, of course, correct me, as sort of a bridge figure between the church and perhaps those like Martin Luther who were, well, not at the beginning, but eventually thinking about reforming the church and thinking about doing things in a different way.
Yeah, that's right. Even in his own day, there are those fellow Catholics who criticized Erasmus by saying things like, Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. And you'll still today see, you know, modern scholars agreeing somewhat with that. Bernd Möller, for example, famously said, you know, no humanism, no Reformation, and Erasmus is kind of the exemplar there. And I think that in many respects that's undoubtedly true. Erasmus didn't like to concede the point because he never sided with the evangelical reformers, Lutheran and otherwise, and very, very much lamented the discord and disunity that came with the Reformation. He actually says at one point, the sum and substance of our religion is peace and concord. And so he's very, very much disillusioned when he sees the rancor introduced with the theological debates of the Reformation.
Talking with Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, about Erasmus. Martin Luther,
How would you describe his relationship with Martin Luther? Friends, intellectual, doing intellectual battle. How would you describe the relationship?
Yeah, well, it's an evolving, or perhaps a devolving relationship. where Martin Luther is teaching, the University of Wittenberg, is founded as a humanist university. It's the first European university that requires, as part of its basic curriculum, a facility with Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. So, I mean, Erasmus and Luther and Luther's university are very much on the same page with that. And Erasmus had, like Luther would later, been very open about criticizing certain aspects of late medieval piety, the sale of indulgences, etc., etc. So when Luther starts doing those things, many people, including Erasmus, think that, oh, we're doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And Erasmus gives him a kind word, and he circulates some of Luther's early writings. But it's only as it increasingly dawns on him that, oh, you and I actually have different agendas, that he realizes we're not on the same page. He doesn't want to provoke a conflict, mm-hmm. and he's kind of pushed into it against his will. It's an interesting kind of unfolding of events that leads to their famous literary debate.
This debate we talk about, where do they have these differences? Where are they having this debate back and forth on specific issues? I know free will and bound will is a big one here.
Right.
Where are they having these debates?
Yeah, that really is the primary emphasis. And it's kind of interesting how that becomes the emphasis. Again, Erasmus hates controversy. He doesn't want to engage. But he's finally provoked to do so, to kind of show which side he's on. And he chooses the issue of free will or bound will for arguably two reasons. One, the necessity of free will is very important to his own program of moral reform. But at the same time, he thinks that the issue of free will is kind of peripheral to Luther's concerns. So he thinks, I can pretend like I'm attacking Luther, but Luther's not really going to care because this isn't a big deal. And I think he's somewhat surprised at the sort of vehemence with which Luther responds. Mm. And Luther, in fact, says, of all of my critics to this point, you, Erasmus, are actually the only one who has pinpointed the real issue in this whole Reformation controversy. So it kind of descends from there.
In the midst of trying to avoid a conflict, he chooses
exactly.
The exact button to push.
That's right.
On Luther that sort of sets off the argument. Why did he not see that coming?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm honestly not entirely sure. But I think it has something to do with this. One of the things that Erasmus writes in kind of defense of his own position is that free will, bound will, you know, if we're looking at Scripture, as we should be as fellow Christians, this is all really complicated, difficult to sort out.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone will acknowledge that that's the case. Therefore, nobody will insist too adamantly one way or the other. So he's surprised by the fact that Luther thinks it's far more clear than Erasmus does. Erasmus a little bit steps on a rake because he once he grants that this is very unclear in Scripture, he says, if I could, I would remain a skeptic. And he doesn't mean a skeptic the way we typically think of that in the modern world, as a kind of liberal, believe whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his influence with the classical tradition, skepticism is actually a very conservative traditional. If we can't figure out the answer, stick with the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But once he says, if he could, he'd be a skeptic, Luther just loses it. His famous line is, the Holy Spirit is no skeptic. God didn't speak through the apostles and the prophets so that we could just shrug our shoulders and say, I'm not sure what this means.
You mentioned a few times, Erasmus is one who is not looking for conflict. I know in some of these writings with Luther at various times, he's essentially telling him to dial it down, bring it back, right? Would things have been different if Erasmus perhaps had taken Luther's writings more seriously earlier on, or engaged him more vociferously with an eye toward a conflict?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I'll be honest. I like Erasmus, but But it's a little bit surprising that he was surprised by Luther's response, because he's been receiving criticism from, you know, his quote-unquote own side for a long time. And Erasmus is not by any means above sarcasm, ridicule. And nonetheless, when people push back, he's always surprised. So, I mean, this perhaps is a flaw in Erasmus.
Dr. Corey Moss, Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College, talking about Erasmus. Dr. Moss, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
My pleasure.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Paul Moreno from the Hillsdale History Department, talking with us about the great game of baseball, and Jackie Robinson in particular, who died this week back in 1972. David Harsanyi is with us, author of the new book, Eurotrash, and Corey Moss, also from Hillsdale's History Department, told us about Erasmus. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
This is RC with today's Cigar of the Month. Present with us is the Partagas Cortado. Wrapped in an elegant Ecuadorian Connecticut seed leaf, the bold 8-inch long Presidente is a soft smoke. Perfect with coffee after breakfast, the Partagas Cortado reaches sublime notes of creamy, spicy, and mineral-rich deliciousness. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, 2143 Hilltop, Redding, California.
North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive in Reading is part of Operation Holiday Salute, honoring our veterans and the men and women who are currently on active duty for their courage, bravery, and sacrifice. North Valley Distributing at 530-222-1500 wants to thank the brave men and women who have taken an oath and have proudly served or are currently serving our country and the American people. North Valley Distributing, part of Operation Holiday Salute on KCNR.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Tobacco and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
Journalism allows its readers to witness history. Fiction gives its readers an opportunity to live it. John Hersey.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our episode today is about journalism. This is another common character archetype to have in stories, and joining us today is Julia Avery, a local journalist.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
So tell us about yourself and your work.
I actually just finished at KRCR, the local ABC station in Reading, just last week. I did report at a station before that for a couple of years, so I have about 5 years of experience now in local news.
How did you get into journalism?
It originally started, I wanted to do sports. I realized how difficult that is, especially for a woman. I went into journalism in college to do that. But once I started learning about the impact that news has, I really got passionate about it and took a whole different direction.
Do you have an inspiration that helped you decide that journalism was going to be your future?
I don't have someone when I first started, but I did an internship in college, and there was a photographer. He had gone to Africa when he was younger, and he had covered the whole unrest there. And he told me this story about how they were actually stoning a woman. He would have been likely stoned too if he was caught filming it, so he kept his camera underneath a jacket, and he got some video and took it back and sent it back. And he said the next day, the president was showing the video and talking about it and saying how they're going to go in and try and help. I'll never forget that story because I just thought, wow, this one guy who went out on a limb and risked his life to get some video possibly saved lives and got the attention of America to be able to do something and try and help them. So that's one inspiration I think about all the time.
So especially in today's world, people have a very distinct idea of what it is to be a journalist. They either picture, what you said, the mainstream media and the accusations of bias and whatever. And then you also have the other side where everybody just pictures Ron Burgundy from Anchorman.
Yes.
Are either of those true when it comes to local journalists?
So I would say no. When it comes to local news, I think that's why I love it so much, because it's someone that lives in your community and wants to tell someone's story or uncover an injustice or something, and actually does all the work, usually themselves when it's in local news, and gets to the bottom of it, then presents it.
So there is a lot of this idea that reporters get their own photog and somebody else edits for them and they can have a helicopter at the snap of their fingers. How much of that has proven true in your own experience?
So really none of it. And when I went into journalism, I thought that that's how it would be. I didn't even know until the first class when they said, you're going to be shooting the video, editing it, tracking it, writing the web story, all of these things. And I just remember being like, just me? No one else is going to do these things? And actually, as you start to get into bigger cities, you get some help. You get a photographer that will follow you around. And if it's a big story, you'll have maybe a van with a satellite truck and things like that. But the local journalists, most of the time, everything that's put out there with their name on it, they did themselves.
So if there's one thing that you could make people understand, what would it be?
I think I'm so passionate about this right now because of the state of everything. But I think it would be that every journalist I've met, and even I don't know the journalists in the mainstream media, but I have friends that know them, or my boss knows a lot of them, and they're all genuinely went into this industry to help people. And they tell you in college, if you're here to be on TV, leave, because it's never going to work, because it's long nights and long hours and a lot of criticism, and you have to actually be passionate about what you're doing for this to be a success for you. We don't want to be destroying unity in people or anything like that.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.